All of you, it's a real treat to be with you. It's well known in Phoenix that Albuquerque is a great congregation. Mr. Scriber took a video clip of you and some of your ensemble activities, and he showed it in services about 2 weeks ago in Northwest Phoenix. So he has been your promoter, and so there's a lot of people there that know of you. And you came off in the show very nicely, I might say. You shine brightly through the light of the camera lens, and it was a good thing to see you. On a personal note, my wife would send her regards. She's not doing as well this week as other weeks. We've had a pretty hard week in our household, so she's not accompanying me, but she would send her regards. And we had my father over for dinner, and he says, "Oh, you're going to Albuquerque. If you see anybody that I know there, tell them hello." And so there's a particular family I say hello to from their time when they were in Colorado Springs. And any others of you that might know my dad, he was kind enough to say, "Well, say hi to them." He's 87. His health is 87 years old. He could have a heart attack or a stroke any time, or he could live to 102 like his mom. And I don't know that I want to look at my dad or take care of him at 102 because he's still somewhat of a maverick. So, in religious circles and those that study theology, there is a school of logic called hermeneutics. It's named after a Greek named Hermes, or a Greek god. And hermeneutics is a particular way in which some people study biblical topics. Hermes was said to be the god of language, and that he created language as a means for communication between the gods and mortal man. Now, as it's all Greek philosophy, it's not a truth any more than the Da Vinci Code is truth, but it is how some people think. And so hermeneutics refers to communicating of a message from someone like God to someone like you. I found in the Britannica 2005 edition, under the word hermeneutics, it says the study of the general principles of biblical interpretation. It is for both Jews and Christians throughout their histories that the primary purpose of hermeneutics and the exegetical methods employed in interpretation has been to discover the truths and values of the Bible. One of the regulations of hermeneutics is to be silent where the Bible is silent and speak where the Bible speaks. We may not assume an idea is correct just because nothing is said to the contrary. Now, this line of reasoning is used by many New Testament readers to display their evidence that the Sabbath is not necessary, because they see in the New Testament, if you use hermeneutical thought, that there's lots and lots of discussions about different things, but very little discussion about the Sabbath. And so, as the New Testament might be void of a lot of information on the New Testament on the subject of the Sabbath, it could be considered as something that's passé. It's something that you could say, well, the Sabbath, since it isn't brought up a lot, really isn't important for us to study. It's an Old Testament thought. Now, the logic in that takes into account that the old is old and done away, and the new is new, and that's what's here for us today. But you know that there is a different thought of that the Old Testament and the New Testament are in one book on your lap here today. It's one book. It has many people looking at the Bible in different sections, but on the surface, in a first reading, some might say, well, the Sabbath, then, yeah, well, maybe it is done away, because there isn't a lot of thought given to it. But on the subject of the Sabbath, we do find Christ giving us some central ideas. And I want to go through the subject then of the Sabbath and try to give you a broader understanding of what the Bible does say about the Sabbath, and I'll maybe bring some things to your attention that you've not quite glimpsed at in the way that I can present them for you today. Now, there are two occasions where Christ had conflict with the Pharisees on the matter of Sabbath keeping. They're covered in Mark chapter 2 and on into chapter 3. And we'll find them also in the book of Matthew. And in Mark 2:23, there is a time here where the Sabbath has come upon them. And here's Christ with his disciples going through some fields. And he's going to be eating out of the grain in the fields. Mark 2, verse 23. And it came to pass that he went through the cornfields on the Sabbath day, and his disciples began, as they went, to pluck the ears of corn. And the Pharisees said unto him, Behold, why do they on the Sabbath day that which is not lawful? And he said unto them, Have you never read what David did when he had need, and he was hungry, and he and those that were with him, how he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar, the high priest, and did eat the showbread, which is not lawful to eat, but only for the priests. And he gave also to them that were with him. Don't you recall that, he says. And he said unto them, The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. So the subject of Sabbath comes up here, and as we continue, we'll come on to the second occasion where there's conflict with the Pharisees. So we're going to read through them both, and we'll do a little study on these two examples. In 3 verse 1, he entered again into the synagogue, and there was a man there which had a withered hand. And they watched him whether he would heal him on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him. And he said unto the man, Who had the withered hand? Stand forth. And he said unto him, Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath days, or to do evil? Is it to save life or to kill? Now they, the Pharisees, held their peace. And when he had looked around about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, he said to the man, Stretch forth your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored whole as the other. And the Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel that they, with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. They were going to try to kill Jesus. Now, as we read this through and glimpsing at it here right now, we see Christ honored the Sabbath and brings the Sabbath subject up, but also we see that he's being judged for his actions to the point that the Pharisees wanted to take his life. Now, in the first episode that we read, starting up in 2, verse 23, the Pharisees considered the eating of grain from the fields on the Sabbath a breaking of their statutes. The Pharisees had designed 39 different laws of their own origination, Pharisaical origination, not biblical origination, on what could or could not be done on a Sabbath. And in these prohibitions that they had outlined, harvesting and threshing were prohibited. You were not to do that on the Sabbath. So he was breaking two of their Sabbath rules. Now Christ responds to them in good Pharisaic tradition by quoting Scripture. And he quotes 1 Samuel 21, verses 1 through 6. 1 Samuel, and you can keep a finger or mark there in Mark if you'd like. 1 Samuel 21. Verse 1, Then came David to Nob to Ahimelech, the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David and said to him, Why are you alone and no man with you? And David said to Ahimelech, the priest, The king has commanded me a business and has said unto me, Let no man know anything about your business, whereabout I send you, and I have commanded you, and I have appointed my servants to such and such a place. Now therefore, what is under your hand, give me loaves of bread in my hand, or what there is present. And the priest answered David and said, There is no common bread under my hand, but only the hallowed bread, if your young men have kept themselves at least from women. And David answered the priest and said to him, Of a truth, women have not been kept from them for about 3 days. since I came out, and of the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is a manner common, yea, though it were sanctified this day in the vessel. So the priest gave him hallowed bread, for there was no bread but that showbread or hallowed bread that was taken from before the Lord to put hot bread in that in the day when it was taken away. And so this is the example. And it's interesting to compare how that the priest knew the ways and mind of God enough to make a couple of questions, get some answers, say, okay, your men can have this bread to eat. They didn't follow a Pharisaical tradition. Now, one Pharisaical tradition of these 39 that they had concerns breakfast. How many of you had eggs for breakfast? I had some. Huevos. They're good. Mine were scrambled with a little cheese. Now, I don't know what kind of a chicken laid those eggs. I presume a laying hen laid them. Their law was, if a laying hen laid an egg, you could not eat that egg because that chicken had worked on the Sabbath to bring forth that egg. But if it had just been a chicken that was around that you were getting ready to someday put on the dinner table, and that chicken happened to lay an egg, that egg you could eat. Because it was considered that that was just a part of the chicken that fell off. And so you can see the Pharisaical mind had to come up with different things. And if you go to buy appliances sometimes, my wife has an electric range that has a Sabbath mode. So that if you are a high Jew, you can pre-program your range to go on and off and take care of your food so you don't have to. There are some things like that. So Christ was aware of their law, and he understood it not to be the law of God. And he used the example of David and the priest to show these Pharisees what he thought. Now, Matthew 12, verse 4, this example is given again. As I said, I'm going to use Mark as a main reference area, but Matthew 12 also contains, and there's a little bit of knowledge in Matthew 12, verse 7 that I especially want you to see. So we'll start, though, with 12, verse 4. How that he, David, entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests? Or have you not read in the law how that on the Sabbath day, the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath, that is, they work on the Sabbath, and are blameless? So there are some things that you can do on the Sabbath, evidently, that are not breaking the law. But I say to you that in this place is one greater than the Sabbath. If you had known what this means, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, you would have not condemned the guiltless. That verse 7 is what I want you to note. And he goes on to say that then in verse 8, for the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. But he says, I will have mercy and not sacrifice. I will have mercy and not sacrifice. He brings to the attention of Sabbath keepers that there is something that we sometimes don't consider that should be part of our Sabbath day, and that is mercy. Having mercy on the men traveling with David so that they could have their hunger taken care of by eating the bread, that was a merciful action. And when you consider as he was going through the fields, his men were hungry. They began to eat the grain in the field. They were taking care of the hunger. This is a merciful thing. Sometimes in our society, we make varying distinctions about what we should or should not do. But sometimes we need to employ the matter of mercy in how we look at our own judgments. And this is something that Christ did. And I'm not going to try to make your judgments for you or tell you what you should or should not do, but try to employ mercy, whatever judgments you make about yourself or others, when it comes to the subject of Sabbath keeping. This was the fault of the Pharisees. They were not a merciful people. They were very structured people to the point of being guilty of breaking the Sabbath. For I desire mercy rather than sacrifice. Now that thought of mercy comes from Christ quoting again from the Bible that they had with them, the Old Testament, Hosea chapter 6, verse 6. Hosea is the first of the minor prophets right after Daniel. And Hosea was written to the Israel camp, the house of Israel, that went into slave labor. And it was written around 760 to 720. The house of Judah was still active. It was not captured and taken into captivity until 585. So at least 100 years before they were taken into captivity, the Jewish people still had their temple and the priesthood. And Christ quotes there in Matthew 12 and in Mark chapter 2, Hosea 6, verse 6, "For I desired mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings." He says these things at the time when the temple is still in existence and there is still a functioning priesthood. He tells them that while you have sacrifices, there's other things I would prefer more than burnt sacrifices: knowledge of me, mercy. This is what I wanted you to have. And it's important to realize when Christ confronts the Sadducees and the Pharisees about their laws, that he does it and shows them that it was applicable while there was still a priesthood functioning, that he desired them to have mercy and not sacrifice. He desired for them to have knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. So the burnt offerings and sacrifices were meant to bring them to a mentality state so that they could understand more about this great God that had given them life. Now the second episode that we started reading in Mark 3 verse 1, the subject of healing comes up because Christ was going to heal a man with a withered hand. And he gets rather indignant and he says he's angry. And it's a tussle sometimes to consider that Christ could have been angry, but he, it says here, was angry. He was very upset. And you might also recall the time that he went into the temple and saw the money changers there. And he left and went and got a whip and went in there and started making people move and turning over their tables. And there's a lot of emotion shown there as well. It's important to consider these things sometimes when you look at our Savior. Now, one of the laws that the Pharisees had is you could not heal on the Sabbath. And I guess they believed in healing and thought healing could be done by them. And maybe it was. But it could only be done if it was a real emergency. A man with a withered hand, he'd had that for years. And so it wasn't an emergency. But their law said you could only do these things if it was an emergency. So somehow they knew when something was an emergency and would perform an anointing or get involved with healing. In Mark 2, Mark 3, when this is happening, and he goes ahead and gets involved with this healing, and this man is made well. He says, "Stretch forth your hand," and he restored it whole. This made them very mad, and yet he has started by saying in 3, verse 4, "Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath days or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" And they held their peace because he had convicted them, again, in a very important matter. Psalm 25, verse 10, Psalm 25, verse 10, says this, "All the paths of the Lord are mercy and truth unto such as keep His covenant and His testimonies." They said, if you're going to keep my covenant and my testimonies, my words, then you're going to be a merciful people and you're going to be following truthful ways. These Jews of that time, whether a Sadducee, Pharisee, Essene, Mystic, whatever they were, didn't understand the law of God, and they had added a lot of their own laws to it. They had added their own do's and don'ts. What Christ is doing is bringing to their attention, in a typical rabbinical style, scriptural argument saying you are not following what the Bible does say. And he employs then their logic, and a godly logic, because he uses it himself, that if something is to be applied in the lesser, it can be then applied in the greater, in something greater. So he was saying here in these, that little thought, is it lawful to do good or evil? If you can do good, then so be it. Now again, keeping maybe a finger in Mark 2, we can go to Matthew 12 once again, where there's a little additional thought brought in for us. 12 verse 11. You can see in 10 how they asked him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath days, that they might accuse him? And then in 12 verse 11, he said unto them, what man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, and it falls in a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? Of course, they had the law of if your cattle or sheep fell into the ditch, you could take it out. It was an emergency. Or on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold of it and lift it out? How much then is a man better than a sheep? Excuse me. He uses again this logic that if it applies in the lesser, if you'll help a sheep, why won't you help a man? A man is greater, of greater worth and value than a sheep. Wherefore, it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath days. Christ gives us example that we should then be thinking of sometimes what applies in the smaller. And you say, well, yeah, I've seen somebody that was stranded and needed help on the Sabbath, and I could help them. You would, if your dog was having problems and it was a special dog to you, you might call a vet and get him into a vet if he'd been bitten by a snake or something like that. I can recall as a youth when my folks would travel from Wyoming down to Colorado for the Sabbath, 180 miles one way. One winter day, on a stretch of highway north of Cheyenne, a family had skidded off the ice, and this was in the mid-50s, late-50s maybe, you know, mid-56 or 7. And tempered glass wasn't all that it is today, and the family had got cut up quite badly, and so Dad quickly put them in the car, and we went into Cheyenne and took them to the hospital rather than wait for the ambulance to come. And it was, have mercy, do what is responsible. And I think all of you would do the same thing. So we need to remember sometimes this principle from Christ that what is we might apply in the least, we should then apply in the greatest matters of life, especially when it comes to mercy. I've outlined here some scriptures in my notes, and I'm just going to read them to you, where Christ gives us that information that He kept the Sabbath faithfully, and He worshipped in the synagogue. Now I'm going to say that again. Christ kept the Sabbath faithfully and worshipped in the synagogue. That quote I took out of the International Bible Standard Bible Encyclopedia. I was flabbergasted to find it in this marvelous large work. They say, quote, Christ kept the Sabbath faithfully and worshipped in the synagogue. And so that's a wonderful thing to know that can be understood. In Mark 1:21 it says that He went into Capernaum, and straightway on the Sabbath day He entered into the Sabbath, into the synagogue, and taught. Mark 6:2 says, and when the Sabbath day was come, He began to teach in the synagogue, and many hearing him were astonished, saying, "From whence has this man these things? What wisdom is this which is given to him, that even such mighty works are worked by his hands?" Luke 4:16. "And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up for to read." Then a few verses later, Luke 4:21, "He began to say to them, 'This day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears.'" And here he was preaching. So it tells us, if you go through these kinds of scriptures, that certainly the New Testament is not silent on the subject of the Sabbath and keeping the Sabbath. And I think it's important for us to know what the Bible does say about these things. I found, as you have in reading Mark 2:27-28, he said the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. I found in this William's New Testament, he wrote at the turn of the century a Bible translation. And he says it this way: "Then he said to them, 'The Sabbath was made to serve man, and not man to keep the Sabbath.'" The Sabbath was made to serve man, and not man made to keep the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. So this, I think, is important to start to think about. It was made for man. Now the word Sabbath, as we read it here in our New Testament, comes from the Greek word sabbaton. And there's two B's in there. And the reason there's two B's is because it's related or taken from the Hebrew word sabbat. Now both sabbaton and sabbat are nouns. And in studying languages, not that I've done a lot of it, but when there's a doubling of a consonant like B, they did that because they're trying to impress upon the reader of language that this is an importance. So Sabbath with two B's, it's double important. It has to be understood as an important word. But Sabbat in Hebrew, S-A-B-B-A-T, came from a Hebrew word with one B, S-A-B-A-T, and that Hebrew word is not a noun, it's a verb. The word Sabbath, as we find it in the New Testament, is sabbaton. But in the Old Testament, when it first comes into biblical studies and reading, it's sabbat and it's a verb. And you might not think of Sabbath as a verb, but it is. And sabbat as a verb means cessation. It's the day of cessation, a day of inactivity. Or as you and I know it, a day of rest. I found, again, in the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, Volume 4, page 247, I copied into my notes on the subject Sabbath. The noun sabbat is derived from the Hebrew verb sabbat, cease, since the most ancient characteristic of Seventh-day observance is that all work ceased. This Sabbath would mean something like cessation day, the day on which all work stops. The Greek noun sabbaton also apparently arose from the influence of the Hebrew sabbat, and in the Revised Standard Version, it renders all 11 occurrences of sabbat as solemn rest, or day of solemn rest. Like sabbat, sabbaton in the New Testament refers both to the observance of the Sabbath day and to feast days. Now, as you've been reading in your, most of you having a King James translation, reading Mark 2:27-28, the Sabbath was made for man. So I want to now do something for you, hopefully useful, and understand what he means when he says it was made, or it was designed especially for man. Could I have a couple fellows do some handouts here for me? And quickly give one to... Hopefully there's enough for every person in the room. If not, that's all I have, except for my copy. We're going to study creation, a time when everything was made. And keep in mind, as I read to you from this Williams, the Sabbath was made to serve man and not man to keep the Sabbath. Let's turn to the first book of the Bible, the first chapter, Genesis. And you can use this crib sheet as a study aid as we go through Genesis 1. I'm going to do it somewhat rapidly, not going through every last word, rather working at principles that occur during Creation Week as we think about Genesis or beginnings. In 1:3, it says, "And God said, let there be light, and there was light." And you know that they called the light day, and the darkness they called night. Evening and morning were the first day. So under day one at the top, I put, He separated light and dark. Now on day 2, which starts with 6, God said, and let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, to let it divide the waters from the waters from the waters, divided the waters from that which was under the firmament from the waters which were above, and so God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. So He divided the waters, and then there's room below for life. That was on the second day. Now on the third day, commencing in 9, "And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth. And the gathering together of the waters called He seas, and God saw that it was good. And God said," 11, He says 2 times on the third day, "God said." God did 2 different things on the third day. The earth brings forth grass, herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after its kind, and so forth. And so, the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding fruit, and the evening and the morning were the third day. So on day 3, I've divided it into part A and part B. He gathers waters to reveal dry land, and then on the second portion of that day, I'm not saying the size of the portions, I don't know that, vegetation after its kind began. Now, uniquely, when we go to day 4, in 14, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. And let them be for lights of the firmament of the heaven, giving light unto the earth, and it was so. The 2 great lights, one to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, He set them in their circle around the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and God said it was good, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day." That's 19. So on day 4, which is the second series of boxes, He made the heavenly lights, the sun and the moon. On day 5, God said, "Let the water bring forth abundantly the moving creature that has life, fowl that may fly above the earth and in the open firmament of heaven." And God created every whale and every living creature that moves, which the waters brought forth abundantly in their kind after their winged fowl after his kind, and God said it was good. So He filled the waters and the seas and the fowl multiplying in the earth, and that was the 5th day. So day 5, there's fish and fowl. On day 6, God said, "Let us make man in our image." But He also said up in 24, "Let the earth bring forth a living creature after its kind, cattle." So you see in 24 and 26, it says God said twice. So we have on day 6 another part A and part B. The first part is the mammals are created. and all kinds of things are upon the earth. And then man is created in the latter part of 26 and going forward. And this is how we then can see a little bit about creation. Now, what are the four principles at work in Creation Week is what I've next asked. And it has to do with the order of the 3 days of creation that you can see doubled. On day one and day four, the separating of light and dark, and then heavenly lights come about. So things are put in their place. Now there's dividing of waters on day two, room below for life, and fish and fowl on day five. Fish and fowl and the dividing, so that there's a place for fish and a place for fowl, is the principle applying to the second and fifth days of creation week. And day 3a and day 6a has to do with motion. A place was made where animals could have activity and move, and then they were created. And so what I put down as a principle of work is motion on 3a and 6a. And then on 3b and 6b, vegetation after its kind, and then mankind after its kind. So you have life created to continue. And I hope you can see, as I put then a phrase or a sentence, do you see the parallel between the first 3 days of creation and the second 3 days of creation? There's something at work doubling itself. Now, I've put in another sidebar, as it were, and it goes off in the next two little areas go off in maybe a little different direction, but they're interesting studies. What are the three blessings of the creation week? Well, to be fruitful, have dominion, and that you're separated and holy. That's interesting to look at those three blessings during the creation week. And then the other one, that again, is slightly unique. What is the ascending order of freedom of motion as outlined during the creation week? In other words, who has the greatest freedom of motion? Man. Because he has the intelligence, he can learn how to put himself on the moon, how to put himself under the water, and be any place in between. Mankind has the widest variation and opportunity to experience motion. Animals have the next. Birds, for the most place, don't spend much time underwater unless they're a penguin. And fish and sea creatures, they don't fly much unless they're a flying fish. Sun, moon, and stars, their motion is set, and plant life just does, dandelions will sprout their little umbrellas and they'll propagate themselves across your grassy yard, but a dandelion just doesn't move. Once the root is set down, that's where the plant life stays. Corn plants don't move around either and move from pasture to pasture, so something to think about. Now, there are four principles revealed about the Sabbath at its creation. And let's look then at chapter 2 when the Sabbath is made. Verse 2, and on the seventh day God ended his work which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all which he had made. Remember, it said the Sabbath was made for man. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made. Uniquely, the four principles that I have tried to show you existing in the first 6 days of creation all apply in the seventh day of creation, Sabbath. The Sabbath has its own particular place, just as the heavenly lights have their place. The Sabbath is appointed at its place the seventh day. On the seventh day, not a seventh day, the seventh day. In our society, there's a lot of people who would rather have that read a seventh day. So they can choose the rotation of the 7 days and have then Sunday to be the day that they have chosen, because it's every seventh day. And uniquely, those that worship the sun, that's how they look at things. And uniquely, those that worship the moon, their seventh-day rotation is on Fridays. And so you've got Friday keepers over on this side, and Sunday keepers over here. Sabbath keepers are in the middle, and they're the minority. And we're bookended by people that worship the moon and worship the sun. Now, we also said we're to find the day as a separate day, as a separation. God blessed the Sabbath day. Now, all the other days that we read through, God saw that they were good. But He blessed the seventh day, it says in verse 3. He blessed the Sabbath day. So it's separate and unique from all the other 6 days of creation. The third principle, motion, God ceased from motion on the Sabbath. He stopped what He had been doing and He rested. It's a day of cessation. And in that, again, I think it's important to realize that when Christ ceased from doing His work on the Sabbath, that didn't mean He ceased from having mercy. When He healed the man with the withered hand, when He let His men eat corn from the field. So it's a day in which you also must employ mercy. As our heritage has gone in the church, I've been aware for all of my existence in these 50 plus years attending our congregations, that we take a lot of time judging each other from time to time, trying to arrive at who's right and who's wrong, rather than being merciful and just realizing that mercy is better than judgment. Now, the other thing that God did, the fourth principle on the creating of the Sabbath, is He put His own life in it. He put His own presence, His life in the Sabbath. If you look at, He rested and God created and made this Sabbath day. He blessed the seventh day and sanctified it because that in it He had rested from all His work. He put His very essence into the Sabbath, His presence. And while you can read the Bible from front to back, you'll find no place where God takes His presence out of the Sabbath and distinguishes it to be now His presence in some other day. The Sabbath is the only day in which He has particularly had His divine interest. So I hope the study of Creation Week and thinking about Genesis adds a little bit more thought to the Scripture when it says the Sabbath was made for man. He wants us to understand the Sabbath has its own place, that it's a separate day, a day where motion ceases from our activities, and also a day in which we look at His life. So when we look at Scriptures, and now let's go to Exodus chapter 20, where the commandment is given, I just want to take one thought, essentially from verse 8, when the Sabbath command starts, going on through verse 11. But I want to see one particular thought from verse 8, Exodus 20, verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day. Now, you could look at that word remember any number of ways, but God is talking to the Israelites, and as they would have had Moses, the author of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, assisting them, guiding them, leading them, he that wrote the words down in Genesis about the creation of Sabbath, he would have had the opportunity to tell them these things and to help them to see what the Sabbath means. So he wants them to remember the fullness of the creation of Sabbath. Not that it's a day of do's and don'ts. It's a day of separation. It's a day of beauty, because God puts His own beauty into it. It's a day in which we really consider significantly the way that He organized the whole creation week. It's a day we consider life. So when He says these things, we're to labor for 6 days and do our kind of labor. But the Sabbath is of the Lord's God. We're not to do our labor. In 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth. He refers to those 6 days. And so it's my projection of thought that I would think that when He brings this to their attention, the forefathers would have known what happened during these 6 days and would have thought through these things. That He made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and then rested on the seventh day, hallowed it, and so it becomes a very blessed day. When we move to Exodus 31 on the subject of Sabbath keeping. We see in verse 13, speak to the children of Israel, saying, verily my Sabbath you shall keep. It is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord that does sanctify you. He sanctified the Sabbath by putting His own self into it, and we become understanding of that being sanctified when we keep it ourselves in this manner. So you should keep the Sabbath. It is holy. Every one of you that defiles it shall surely be put to death. If you do any work, you shall be cut off from among His people. 6 days were to work. The seventh day is the Sabbath. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. So wherefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath, throughout their generations for a perpetual covenant. And the perpetual word stands real strong for us at this point then, because we see that He has not put an end to it. It's perpetual. It is continual. Now in Exodus 35, He amplifies this one more time. Verse 2, 6 days shall work be done, but on the seventh day shall be unto you a day of rest in the Lord. Whosoever does work therein shall be put to death. You shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations upon the Sabbath day. And Moses spoke to the congregation, saying, this is the thing which the Lord commanded. Take you from an offering before the make an offering of blue and purple and so forth, and rams and oil and onyx stones and so forth. But when you start to read about this offering, the first thing he mentions in verse 5, bring an offering to the Lord, then the last phrase of verse 5, gold and silver and brass. Now that then defines what kind of fire he's talking about in verse 3. A fire big enough that you could smelt. That's the kind of fire. He's not talking about a fire. Don't build a fire that will keep you warm. He's talking about a fire that you would use to work. So when you turn to Numbers chapter 15, there is a man gathering sticks. In verse 32, and while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man that gathered sticks upon the Sabbath day. And they found him gathering sticks, brought him to Moses. What should we do with him? They put him in word, because it wasn't declared what we should be done to him. And the Lord said to Moses, the man shall be surely put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones without the camp. And all the congregation brought him without the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died as the Lord commanded Moses. Now then, it wasn't just the gathering of sticks, but what was he going to do with the fire that these sticks were gathered for? And it would indicate, as we've moved from Exodus 35, that it was sticks so that he could work. He was breaking the Sabbath. He was doing his work. It wasn't that he was making a fire to keep himself warm or to boil a cup of water to make the beverage of the day. I don't know if it was Ovaltine or green tea or what they were having that back then, but maybe it was just the chocolate milk he was after. I don't know. That's supposed to be funny, but anyhow, it's important to realize these things. It starts to add to the momentum of seeing about the subject of God. As we've read scriptures where he says to be merciful, evidently this man was not one for which mercy could be extended. It wasn't something done naively or without understanding. He was doing something wrong. And when we move to Deuteronomy chapter 5, the second place where the commandments are mentioned in the Old Testament here, Deuteronomy 5, and the subject of the Sabbath is in verses 12 through 15. Deuteronomy 5, 12. Keep the seventh day to sanctify it as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you nor those that are under your control, so forth. Verse 15, and remember that you were a servant in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath holy. Now they came out of Egypt and marched through those deserts, crossed a dry seabed that God dried for them. Put yourself back in that time frame, and they did that for a week. During that week, sometime, more than likely, there was a Sabbath, and they were walking. So that doesn't mean that you couldn't walk on the Sabbath, and yet the Jewish law says you can't walk more than about 1,000 paces from your house. That's one of their regulations. A Sabbath day's journey is about 1,000 steps from your premises. Having been in Jerusalem for quite a long time at one point, I found that the way the Orthodox people get around that law and how they've interpreted it as what a Sabbath day journey is, they take shoes with them. And they'll drop a shoe after they've done 1,000 steps. Then they can go 1,000 more. And so they just parade their shoes down the street and they can keep going Sabbath day's journey from their house because their house, well, that's where my shoes are. Yes, that's what they do. Isaiah 58. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight. Okay, so what we find, and again, not getting into specifics, but the application of thought we've learning about the Sabbath is when we turn away our foot, we don't do our things, but we do things that are delightful and pleasurable. Then honoring God on the Sabbath day, not doing your own ways, your own pleasure, or your own words. Do God's ways, God's pleasure, God's words. And there's a lot of things that we can do along those lines so that we can make the Sabbath serve as it should serve. Then you shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride upon the high places of the earth, feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. So in conclusion, we come all the way down to Hebrews chapter 4. It says in verse 9, therefore there remains a rest to the people of God. In my margin, and my King James Bible says, or a keeping of Sabbath for the people of God. The people of God are Sabbath keepers. Now, we live in times when people have made fun of us because we've kept the Sabbath. We might even have lost friends and relatives, family, because we consider the Sabbath properly to be honored. But I thought if I would take advantage of the opportunity, and just look at that word made. Christ says the Sabbath was made for man. And see what happened when He made the Sabbath. We can learn more about the essence of this day and how important it is to be keeping it with our Father in heaven and with each other and apply mercy rather than sacrifice.